Motherhood has been used to oppress and exploit women for centuries, but it doesn't have to be this way, and as mothers, we're ready for a revolution. We love our kids, but we struggle with losing our identities, bearing the weight of motherhood without enough support, and striving to meet those impossible standards of what it means to be a good mother. It's time to openly discuss how motherhood is deeply affected by patriarchy, racism, and capitalism, so that we can break free of these systems. As mothers, we know our work is valuable and has radical potential to birth a more equitable and inclusive future for ourselves and our children. Welcome to the Rebel Mothers Podcast. I'm your host, Susie Fischleiter, and together we'll explore the challenges of modern motherhood and reclaim mothering as an act of liberation. Hello, and welcome to part two of The Economics of Motherhood. Last week, we discussed the cost of motherhood, the cost of actually being a mother in the United States. And this week, we're going to go upstream to see where this all started. Today, first, we're going to talk about the different economic systems that we're all somewhat familiar with. Capitalism, socialism, maybe a little bit of communism. I'm going to give a breakdown of what motherhood looks like or might look like in each of these systems. And then we're going to look at some inherent problems in all of these different economic systems, and I might propose some alternatives, like things you might not be familiar with, the sharing economy, a gift economy, and how those might affect mothers. Really, this episode is all about fundamentally rethinking how do we share resources, allocate resources to people who need them? What's the best way to organize this system of giving and receiving of time, information, care work, you know, all the things through the lens of motherhood. So we're looking at economics through the lens of motherhood. Now, again, my disclaimer, as we get into it, I am not an economist. I'm a maternal scholar. My field of expertise is motherhood, motherhood studies. So again, we're going to go into super high level, super basic economic definitions here. So we're all on the same page. I went down so many rabbit holes researching this episode, but I want to try and keep it simple for me to understand, and then so we can have just an open conversation. Okay, first step, what do I mean when I'm talking about the economics of motherhood? Well, like I started saying, at its core, economics is the study of how societies allocate their limited resources to satisfy their wants and needs. It is considered a social science, economics is, and that studies the value, production, distribution, and consumption of goods and services. We often think of the economy as something that takes place in the public sphere, the market economy, right? Like I go to Target and I buy a new pillow and I've just participated in the market economy. But there's so much more to economics, especially when we consider the time, energy, and labor that goes into the production of these goods and services. And when we move our lens from the public market economy to the private sphere, the home, this is where things get really interesting and relevant to the topic of this podcast. In fact, the word economics comes from a Greek word, I'm probably going to mispronounce it, oikonomia, which it means managing the household. The very root of economics is related to the home. So when I'm talking about the economics of motherhood, I'm talking about looking at how societies allocate the resources in ways that directly affect the experience of being a mother. And I think it's important to remember that economics is unlike a natural science. It's considered a social science, but it's not a natural science in that it is a completely human construction. It's not rooted in like the laws of gravity or the laws of the earth, right? All the rules about exchange and labor and pricing and everything are made up by humans. And as a human constructed system, the people who made up the rules of this system over hundreds of years brought their own biases and assumptions to it. So for example, for the first 100 years of our country, African Americans were completely excluded from accessing any financial services, right? Like banks or loans, and obviously faced significant barriers to economic advancement. And the systemic racism continues to show up today as a persistent black-white wealth gap. According to a 2019 report, median black families have 10 times less wealth than median white families. Women were also excluded from most economic activities for hundreds of years. For much of European and American history, women were legally and socially restricted from owning property, earning their own income, or managing their finances independently. It wasn't even until 1974 that women were allowed to access credit on equal terms as men. So it's important to remember that when we talk about motherhood and economics, we remember that for women, for mothers of color, you know, we are unlearning hundreds of years of conditioning about money and exchange and property and our worth and the value of our labor. So now let's look at some specific economic systems so we have an understanding of what we're dealing with, right? Okay, there are many different economic systems available, but the ones we're most familiar with are probably capitalism, socialism, and communism. At least that's what I learned about growing up. And of course, I was taught that capitalism was the best economic system because it was wrapped up in the American dream that anyone could be rich and successful if you just worked hard enough. And I was also taught that communism is bad because it meant that you didn't own anything and the government owned it all and could decide who gets what and everyone had to dress the same and for some reason everything is gray. This is obviously pretty simplistic, but I think this is what a lot of kids growing up in the US are taught even still today. But we're not kids anymore. We are smart, capable adults who can tackle complex and contradicting ideas full of nuance without resorting to calling one thing good and another thing bad. So let's learn a little bit. Who's ready for a nerdy history lesson about economics? Yay! Here we go. Adam Smith. Let's talk about capitalism first. Adam Smith is the guy who literally wrote the book on capitalism in 1776, known as The Wealth of Nations, which was the first modern work to treat economics as a comprehensive system and as an academic discipline. I found it interesting. I guess I didn't realize this, that The Wealth of Nations, 1776, capitalism seems like it was somewhat solidified the same year as the United States. Anyway, Smith developed the concept of the division of labor and wrote about how rational self-interest and competition can lead to economic prosperity. Smith accepted the belief that people are inherently selfish, but he was also an optimist. He believed that this selfishness could be used to work for the common good if people were left to create production and commerce without government interference. Now remember, this is 250 years ago. Government interference meant something very different back then. Smith was educated at Oxford, and he wrote this book in England. He was working in England, which was undergoing major social change. If you haven't listened to the Jenny Marks episode, go back and listen to what England was like at that time. That was 100 years after Smith. But where he was writing, at the time he was writing, land that used to be shared in common and worked by farmers was now in the middle of being privatized, or had mostly been privatized. This is a move known as the enclosure of the commons. This meant that farmers and their families, instead of being able to sustain themselves on the land, now they had to try and find work as paid laborers. So, you know, they didn't have, Marx will talk about this, they didn't have access to the means of production. They only had access to their own bodies, their own labor, okay? So mining jobs, manufacturing jobs, these were the jobs that were common, and they were also horrific. There was no regulation on child labor, working hours, payment, anything like that. And the quote-unquote government at the time were the landed gentry. Basically, it was the merchants and landowners who had money, and they did nothing to improve these conditions. So when Smith was writing against government interference, he was criticizing the economic control of the upper class. In the book Real Wealth of Nations by Rianne Eisler, she wrote, "At the center of Smith's thinking was the belief that the primary engine for building a better society is the market, that is, the production and exchange of goods for profit through commercial transactions." End quote. He believed that this would ensure that the common man wasn't cheated or exploited and that the living standards would rise. And in many ways, he was right. Capitalism was absolutely an improvement over feudalism. It more evenly distributed resources, so instead of kings and nobles owning everything, now you have more of a middle class. However, as Eisler writes, quote, "Capitalism emphasized individual acquisitiveness and greed, the profit motive, relied on rankings, the class structure, continued traditions of violence, colonial conquests, slavery, and wars, and failed to recognize the economic importance of the women's work, of caring and caregiving. In these and other ways, capitalism retained significant dominator elements." End quote. Now let's fast forward 75 years or so to Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. Marx and Engels propose a different theory of economics called scientific socialism. It seems clear to them that capitalism had failed to fulfill its promise of rising living conditions and non-exploitation. Marx and Engels witnessed the poverty and the working conditions of London's working class, and they were horrified by what they saw. So they begin to examine economics in terms of, like I said, the control of the means of production and in terms of class struggle. They believe that capitalism inevitably results in a class conflict between the bourgeoisie or the owner class and the proletariat or the working class, right? If capitalism survives based on profit, you have to keep costs down and, you know, profit up, which means costs include wages for labor. So there's like this inherent struggle between these two, you know, the owners and the workers, okay? So Marx and Engels wrote about socialism as a stepping stone to their eventual goal of communism. Communism, they envisioned as a stateless, classless society where the means of production are collectively owned and controlled by the community as a whole. So in a communist society, there's no private property. Resources are distributed according to the principle from each according to their ability to each according to their needs, right? Communism's aim was to eliminate social hierarchies, eliminate exploitation and alienation, and to create a society where individuals are free to pursue their interests and develop their full potential. Now, I want to pause here for a second and remind everyone that, for what it's worth, Karl Marx died in 1883. He did not ever live to see his theories named as Marxism. He did not live to see communism be put into practice. I'm going to talk about the realities of these economic systems in a moment and how they affect mothers. But I think Marx gets a really bad rep and a lot of the blame for some of the horrors inflicted under Stalin and Mao's attempts at communism. But Karl Marx was a philosopher who spent most of his life in poverty because of his commitment to the idea that people shouldn't be exploited, and I think he deserves a little more credit. Okay, there we have it. So to sum it up in extremely simplistic terms, capitalism is an economic system where private individuals and businesses own the means of production and operate for profit. In capitalism, goods and services are produced and exchanged in markets based on supply and demand. Competition and the pursuit of profit drive innovation, efficiency, and economic growth. The market determines prices, wages, and the allocation of resources with minimal interference from the government. Capitalism encourages individual initiative, entrepreneurship, and investment with the goal of maximizing wealth and prosperity. Socialism is an economic and political system characterized by collective ownership and democratic control of the means of production, distribution, and exchange. In a socialist society, the means of production, like factories or natural resources, are owned and managed either by the state or by worker cooperatives. So the goal of socialism is to create a more equitable society by ensuring that resources are distributed according to need rather than profit. Socialism advocates for social welfare programs, things like universal health care, child care, education, aiming to reduce income inequality and provide a higher standard of living for all members of society. Communism, on the other hand, is a stateless, classless society where the means of production are collectively owned and controlled by the community as a whole. So in a communist society, there is no private property. Resources are distributed according to the principle, like I said, from each according to their ability to each according to their needs. This is a phrase from Marx. Communism aims to eliminate social hierarchies, exploitation, and alienation, creating a society where individuals are free to pursue their interests and be their, you know, get that Maslow's self-actualization, highest needs. Okay, I'm done with the nerdy economics lesson. I hope you listened and didn't just fast forward. So now let's take a look at what mothers might experience under each of these economic systems. Each system has benefits and challenges, so let's just examine them through the lens of a mother. We'll start with capitalism. In a capitalist society like the United States, mothers, like our fictional Emily from last week, face plenty of economic hurdles, from healthcare and childcare costs to income disparities and the undervaluing of domestic labor. Scholars like Sylvia Federici shed light on the invisible yet crucial role of women's household labor in sustaining capitalism, advocating for its recognition and compensation to challenge patriarchal structures. So the concept of the family as a unit of reproduction further underscores how the nuclear family can perpetuate capitalist systems by providing unpaid labor and, you know, kind of fueling consumption. Now, despite these challenges, capitalism also offers certain opportunities for mothers, such as avenues for entrepreneurship, innovation, consumer choice. You know, mothers have the opportunity to spend their money on their values, encouraging manufacturers to create safe, environmentally friendly, and high-quality products that are produced at equitable and inclusive companies. In theory, capitalism offers the promise of wealth for everyone, regardless of your socioeconomic status when you're born. This is that American dream, right? If you work hard enough, you can succeed no matter who you were when you were born. Of course, this ignores the reality of systemic racism, gender inequality, prejudice against disability, you know, all the other factors that might affect a mother's opportunities. But those are some of the good things capitalism offers. So now let's look at socialism. So in contrast to capitalism's lack of socialized care, socialist-leaning countries like Sweden, Finland, and Denmark prioritize social welfare policies and gender equality. They provide extensive support for mothers through parental leave, subsidized childcare, and universal healthcare. However, mothers in socialist economies might encounter challenges like the allocation of resources, bureaucratic inefficiencies, right? These economies aren't perfect either. Now, communism, in theory, promises a reimagining of motherhood within a framework of equality and collective responsibility. So you'll have communal care systems, welfare programs that alleviate burdens associated with childcare and domestic labor. However, in practice, some of the communist regimes that we've seen, like the Soviet Union and Mao's China, implemented policies to support mothers, but also faced a lot of challenges, like the conflicting demands between work and family responsibilities, a lot of social disruption caused by authoritarian political campaigns, contradictions in policies, right? We've heard of the famines, things like that. So all of these systems have their good, their bad. And obviously I could spend all day talking about them. I mean, people spend their whole lives and careers studying them, but I am not an economist. To me, the whole point of what I've just talked about is that it's clear that there are fundamental problems with all of the systems I've just summarized. And this is what I actually want to talk about. Here's a quote that sums up the inherent problems, again, from the book The Real Wealth of Nations by Reanne Eisler. The theories of both Smith and Marx and Engels made enormous contributions to our understanding of economics. But because they came out of societies that had only moved a few steps toward a partnership system, the scope of what they examined and proposed did not go far enough. Neither of these economic theories achieved their goal of creating an economy that works for the greater good of all. Nor could this goal have been achieved in the context of societies still largely orienting to the domination system, where social and economic structures, as well as the cultural values, maintain top-down rankings of domination and inhibit caring practices and policies. End quote. The problem is that the way we are currently looking at economics is that what we have offered all end up failing to actually meet the needs of the majority of people. Not just the basic survival needs of like food, water, shelter, healthcare, safety, although some fail to even meet those. I'm talking about the Maslow's hierarchy of needs of love and belonging, respect and self-esteem, and moving into self-actualization to achieve one's fullest potential in life. Things are better now than they've ever been. Right? If you look at all of human history, this is probably where you might choose to end up. If you could pick anywhere or any when you'd like to live, this is probably it. We don't face a lot of famine. We don't face a lot of war and conquest. Sure, there's problems, but like we've conquered a lot of disease, right? So we've made these incredible strides in humanity, and we've invented all these labor-saving devices like the washing machine and the sewing machine and cars and airplanes, things like that. We've made all these strides. So why are there still so many people who are working, struggling just to get their basic survival needs met? It feels like we should have met those by now, right? We should have met all those now. Everyone should have access to everything that they need to survive. And now we can like move on, move up. How do we elevate all of humanity based on everything we've done so far? Basically, our understanding of economics fundamentally focuses on the wrong things, because we're still operating under assumptions that prioritize the needs of some people over the needs of others. A healthy society should not emphasize or encourage any type of domination or top-down rankings in pursuit of profit or power or control, but should instead require an economic system that prioritizes optimal human development. You hear a lot today about how the future of work is all about creativity, imagination, and collaboration, right? Human skills that artificial intelligence cannot replicate. Which means if we actually want to talk about economic success, we shouldn't just be focusing solely on like the means of production or the monetary income per person, but instead we should be developing the capabilities of each person, each human. None of the economic systems I just discussed prioritizes human development as the main goal, right? Emphasizing, you know, moving beyond basic survival needs to making sure that each person is living their fullest creative potential. And we know, based on decades of neuroscience and psychology, that in order for adults to develop into fully capable humans, they need to receive quality care as children with secure attachment. So any conversation about economics should prioritize discussions about caring for one another, especially caring for children. Here's another quote from Eisler. Once we recognize the importance of caring in economics, we also see that many of our social and environmental problems are the result of economic rules, practices, and policies that promote, and often even require, a lack of caring. That most economics don't mention care is appalling. It is, however, understandable, since the two theories that shaped modern economics came out of times when most people accepted the superiority of men over women. And with this, the devaluation of anything considered feminine rather than masculine, including caring and caregiving. While Smith expected women to selflessly care for others, he saw this woman's work as unproductive and considered women's subordination natural. Despite their ambivalence about what they called the woman question, Marx and Engels did condemn male dominance, but rather than recognizing the value of women's economic contributions on the home, they too relegated the work of caregiving to reproduction rather than production. End quote. So, what can we do to create an economy that truly works for the greater good of all? One that prioritizes optimal human development and fosters collaboration, creativity, compassion, and caring. How can we redefine success, not solely in terms of monetary income or production, but in terms of human flourishing and fulfillment? Moreover, how do we challenge the deeply ingrained societal norms that devalue caregiving and perpetuate gender inequalities? How can we elevate the importance of caring in economics and recognize the essential contributions of caregivers, especially mothers, to our society? To address the inequities embedded in any of the current economic systems, alternative paradigms must be considered. So let's talk about a couple of alternative economic systems that have already been in place for thousands of years that might offer some solutions: the gift economy and the sharing economy. The gift economy, also known as gift culture or gift exchange, is a social system based on the voluntary giving and sharing of goods, services, and resources without the expectation of immediate or direct compensation, right? It's a gift. You're giving a gift. And having an economy based on just giving everything away might seem like a novel or ridiculous concept in modern times. The gift economy has deep historical roots and has been practiced by various societies for thousands of years. Anthropologists have documented the existence of gift economies in indigenous cultures around the world, right? These societies often operate on these principles of reciprocity and mutual aid, right? Where individuals exchange gifts to strengthen social bonds, demonstrate generosity, and ensure the well-being of the community as a whole. Unlike market-based economies, where transactions are, you know, mediated by currency and market prices, gift exchanges are guided by principles of trust, gratitude, and social obligation. And gifts might take various forms, including material goods or labor, the gift of knowledge, acts of kindness. We see gifts economy today, even, right, in some things like baby showers, hand-me-downs, also in things like meal trains for new parents. So the gift economy operates on this principle of abundance rather than scarcity, and emphasizes the idea that resources are shared and distributed according to need rather than trying to get this individual accumulation of wealth, this sort of private hoarding of wealth and all the good stuff. So what would this mean for mothers? Well, in a gift economy, the emphasis on mutual support and collective responsibility would undoubtedly alleviate the burden of childcare and domestic labor by fostering networks of care and assistance within the community. Mothers might receive support from relatives, neighbors, or other community members, allowing them to share childcare responsibilities and access resources and assistance when needed. We know that children benefit from having multiple caregivers, right? They need at least one secure attachment to one adult, but they thrive when they are securely attached and learning behaviors and modeling ways of being human from multiple different types of adults in their life. Additionally, going back to the gift economy, it really challenges that like commodification of caregiving and domestic work. So instead of putting a price on how much childcare is worth, we recognize the intrinsic value of these activities, right? So instead of viewing caregiving solely as like unpaid labor or underpaid labor, the gift economy acknowledges the importance of nurturing and supporting others as essential aspects of human relationships and community life. Another alternative economy is known as the sharing economy, sometimes called collaborative consumption or peer-to-peer sharing. And this is a socioeconomic system based on sharing, renting, or lending of goods and services, among individuals or groups. Again, anthropologists have documented many cultures that have long practiced systems of sharing and reciprocity within their communities. These could be sharing food, shelter, tools, and knowledge among members of the community, again, based on principles of mutual aid and cooperation. You can think of contemporary examples like platforms like Airbnb, which allow individuals to rent out their homes or spare bedrooms, right? Car sharing services like Zipcar. Members of Zipcar can access cars on a short-term basis when they need it. Other sharing economies could include things like co-working spaces, community gardens, tool libraries, time banks. Right? Members exchange services or skills based on mutual needs and interests. They share what they have with people who need it when they need it. So the sharing economy, instead of prioritizing profit, it really operates on the principles of like access over ownership. So, and could use technology and social networks to facilitate the distribution of these resources and assets, right? Imagine the power of Amazon's distribution model, but instead of distributing stuff that we buy from Amazon from warehouses, it's distributing food to people in need, water to people in need, healthcare and medicine, care work somehow, right? Like, we can just think beyond just individual consumption and profit to could we use this technology to redistribute the goods and services that people need. And so then instead of somebody or like a company owning and maintaining, you know, goods or resources, individuals could share them or access them. I think about this all the time in like my neighborhood. I look in the garage and I look at like our ladder, right? We use our ladder, I don't know, maybe once a month if we're like changing a light bulb or trying to get a spider web down. So that means 29 out of 30 days, our ladder's just sitting there. And every house on our street has a ladder or two or three that are just sitting there in their garage. They're like not being used. Why doesn't our street just have one ladder or two ladders? Well, the ladder making companies don't want that. They want to sell as many ladders as possible. And that is because we live in an economy that's prioritizing profit. The ladder making companies have to make a profit for their shareholders. In a sharing economy, the priority is not profit, the priority is access to these shared goods, okay? So again, I'm not gonna solve all the problems of the world in this episode, but I'm hoping to encourage you guys to think about how some of these things might fundamentally change the way we live our lives. Now, what would motherhood look like in a sharing economy? Well, obviously, it would provide access to a wide range of goods and services without the need for ownership. What if there were a membership where it was like you could every year get a year's worth of clothing for your children at the age that they are, seasonally appropriate, that kind of thing. And then at the end of the year, you give it back to the company, and then you get the next year. And then the clothes just go on and on, and we're all sharing it instead of like going to Target and buying everything and then giving it away to Goodwill, or, you know, just thinking about sharing goods, sharing resources. This really would promote resource efficiency, sustainability, right? And then also the sharing economy could really foster community connections, social networks. It provides opportunities for mothers to connect with their neighbors, connect with other parents, local organizations. Through shared resources and collaborative initiatives, mothers support each other, they share knowledge, they share experiences, and they build these stronger support networks, which is what every single mother I talk to says they need more support in one way or another, right? And there are things that exist today, like you'll find sharing banks on, you know, Facebook, things like that, car sharing services, free cycle, I think it's called. So there are options out there. And that is, again, one of the points I want to drive home. The gift economy, the sharing economy, these aren't like harebrained utopian notions of some mom who's like, wouldn't that be great? They already exist. We're already doing some of them. We can keep doing more of them, right? We can prioritize these different types of economies in our own life. So, okay, where am I? Hopefully, I think that's it. I think that's all I wanted to talk about. So hopefully this episode was helpful to understand better how economics affects motherhood. It's starting to become clear to many. It's not just me that's like having these ideas. This is in the zeitgeist right now. Many people are starting to realize that the traditional economic systems that we have, capitalism, socialism, whatever, have some inherent flaws when it comes to meeting the diverse needs of mothers and families. However, we can explore alternative economic paradigms like the gift economy and the sharing economy, and we can start to find like potential solutions that already exist that instead of prioritizing profit, prioritize this human flourishing, caring, compassion, that uplifting of human potential that's really going to take humanity to like the next level and solve a lot of the big problems we're facing in our world. So as I wrap it up today, I'll just leave you with this idea that as we continue to explore the intersection of economics and motherhood, it's just essential to consider the potential to reshape our understanding of value, labor, worth, and human flourishing in the pursuit of a more just and equitable world for all. Stay tuned for more empowering stories and insightful discussions in future episodes of Rebel Mothers. Remember to subscribe, rate, and share this podcast to spread the message far and wide. Learn more at susiefishleader.com, and thank you for being part of the motherhood revolution.